AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Tick, 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 tick. Boom! We are on the up once again. Welcome to your Meltdown Monday, beautiful peeps. Whether or not you are viewing us on your YouTube stations or you are dropping the audio delights into your ears while driving to or from work, welcome, welcome to you all. Welcome to the Meltdown. My name's Tom Finkill. I am your rep here in Manchester. Yes, we wave the red, white and blue as you do in the States. But ours has got a big cross in the middle of it. We hope you've had a sensational week coming off our SummerSlam preview last Monday. And we have got a mega treat for you today. Oh, this one's going to be a thriller of a natural born size. It's going to be amazing. Well, 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 as we get prepared for another epic week, summer is well in the swings. It is hot and baking, even here 10 p.m. at night over in Manchester. But that heat is nothing compared to the nuclear heat that is currently coming off my tag team partner. Are you ready for the creation of devastation? I bring to you Brian Clark. Woo!
And he is the three-time UK host of the year and a Guinness Book World Record holder and my tag team partner, Mr. Tom Finkill. I'm doing great, my man. Good day to the Tomcat, and thank you for a great intro, as always. So I got to ask you, Tom, how goes it this fine afternoon in Manchester?
It's all right today, you know, it's been a crazy week because the kids are off school with summer holidays. Sophia's been filming different shows and myself and my wife have been driving to and from Liverpool. So for all our Beatles fans out there, yes, here comes the sun. We have left it there and brought it back to Manchester. But for those of you that frequent theme parks around our world, and if you've got a Jurassic World section where you can go and meet a live dinosaur and you'll stand there with your pictures and you'll smile with your families, and then a velociraptor will charge behind you and get you jumping out of the way. That's currently my son that's doing that, right? He's all in. He is built inside a velociraptor. And that is some massive technology in there, right? So you've got pulley systems that operate the eyes, operate the mouth, operate sound. And he's got a nice little monitor so he can see. And I asked him what his favorite part of the day was. He went, "Dad, I had the best time inside that dinosaur. I made 27 kids cry." I was like, "That is amazing, mate. Amazing, amazing. You have hit that dream hard at 15. I love it. So yeah, it's been a great week, man. How about you? What have you been up to?"
Oh man, keeping busy. And the Meltdown is turning into a full-time project, as you know. We're going back and forth. As we always say, booking ain't easy, but we're doing it. We're doing it each and every day, man, and we're loving it. I'm going to tell you, Tom, you're talking about monsters. How about a guy that we've got today, a 6'6" monster? Today's guest is an Auburn, New York native and a former collegiate basketball player at NCAA Division III Cuca College. And I got a fun fact of the day for you, Tomcat. Did you know that Cuca means canoe landing?
Didn't know that.
Or lake with an elbow. Hey, research also pays off.
Tell me about it. No one wants to say that elbow. I like it.
Yeah. This gentleman here today, he is a former, check this out, two-time WCW Tag Team Champion, a CMLL Trios Champion in Mexico, a CMLL Heavyweight Champion, and he was known as one of the most well-conditioned and athletic big men during his professional career. the Meltdown Universe welcomes Mr. Mark Jindrak. Let's go.
What's up, fellas?
Welcome, brother.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hot day, summer in the city in Tennessee, right?
Oh, yeah. It's pretty hot. It's pretty hot here, but not as hot as where Brian's at right now, right?
Scorcho.
Yeah, he's got me by like 15 or 20 degrees. So,
and we still have got another at least a month of this. But the plus is living in Tucson is that when the fall comes around, it's just gorgeous. I mean, it's shorts from now until, you know, year round. Honestly, you just
Arizona's good for your body too. Like, I mean, you know, we're ex wrestlers. You eat the bumps and bruises we feel every day. Yeah. I heard the just the humidity and the moisture and stuff just feels real good for the body, you know.
It does. I'm from Florida in the Panhandle area, and I would not. I have family that lives there, but I would not move back. I'm so acclimated to this. I've been out here for 20 plus years, and I love it. We love it, and not going back anytime other than to visit the East Coast. That's it.
Yep.
Yeah. So, hey, Mark. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we're going to take a little dive into your career. We got some great questions for you. We're going to have some fun. That's what we do. We have some fun on here because if we're not having fun, there's no reason in doing it. Okay.
Okay.
So I know that your first love was for the game of basketball.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But what or who gave you the idea to try pro wrestling?
It was kind of a crazy story because between my sophomore and junior year of playing basketball at CUCA, good reference, by the way. I didn't know it had to do with the canoe landing. So, but a couple of guys I played hoops with, they were going to move down to Orlando, Florida for to start their careers. Okay. And so they said, hey, why don't you come down for the summer, hang out, do us a favor, drive the U-Haul so we can drive our cars and just hang out for the summer, you know, and when you're ready, you know, just head back up north and go back to school, you know, for your junior year. And I thought it was a great idea, so that's what I did. So when I got to Orlando, you know, they had job stuff. I had to get a job as well, so, and I didn't have a car there. So we lived on International Drive, which is tons of places. I ended up being a waiter at a Denny's at SeaWorld. SeaWorld Denny's was a waiter, okay?
Were you flipping burgers? What were you doing?
No. I was waiting tables. I was actually like, hey, okay, so welcome to Denny's. My name is Mark. You know, what can I get you today?
A 6'6 monster here. Hey, welcome to Denny's, right? Okay.
Yep. But hey, but you know, like I was so young. I was so young. Yeah. Just like, and here's the deal. I could walk there. You know, I didn't, you know, transportation was a big thing. So my friends, you know, they'd go to work every day for 12 hours. And I would just kind of hang out. What I'd end up doing was working the graveyard shift. So I worked like at, you know, from like 10 o'clock to, you know, 6 in the morning. And I liked it because they gave me weekends off because that was when I was going to hang out with the boys. You know, they had the weekends off and that was going to be my summer fun. So what happened was into that work job, one night it was maybe like when I first got on, maybe at 11 o'clock or so. And a couple of the wrestlers walked in. Two wrestlers. I didn't know they were wrestlers, but one was Alex Wright, and another guy was named Barry Houston. That was his work name. I don't know if you know.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's great. I know both of those guys. I know Barry, and, of course, we had Alex on a few episodes back. So, yeah, great.
Yeah. Love it. So they came into Denny's, right, and I ended up waiting on the table, and Alex is more to himself. He was kind of just, you know, chilled to himself and just wanted to eat and just kind of, I don't know, I think maybe he might have called home or something. And Barry was very, like, outgoing and stuff. And he was like, you know, hey, man, you're a pretty tall guy. You know, what are you doing? I explained to him I played basketball. I'm just kind of hanging out for the summer. And he's like, hey, do you like wrestling and stuff? I said, I used to love wrestling, you know, basically Hogan. Basically when Hogan beat Iron Sheik, that, and, you know, until I hit puberty, that was that was the time I watched. So I said, yeah, but I haven't watched, you know, I put it down. I play basketball now. He's like, man, you have a good body, man. You'd probably be a good wrestler. And I was like, yeah, I'm a basketball player, you know. So we just had a little, you know, back and forth. They end up leaving. The night goes on. It's like maybe 3 in the morning. And it's just pretty much no one's in the restaurant, no customers, just me, the dishwasher, and the cook. So I'm just kind of waiting for people to come in. And then all of a sudden two guys come in. And the guy goes, you got 4 quarters for a dollar? And I said, sure. And I opened the register. When I opened the register, one guy pulls out a gun, puts it up, you know, puts it in my hand. And the other guy had a pipe And he's like, just give me all the money. And I was like, yeah, take it, take it. You know, no problems here. So they took the money and they bounced. And, you know, and silly me, you know, young me, you knew me when I was a little bit mature. This, imagine 4 years, 3 years before that. I was like, I thought at first I was like, oh my God, I could have gotten shot. But then I was like, wow, that was so cool. I can't believe I got, you know, because I come from a small city, Auburn, New York. Yeah. You know, I'd never really kind of been anywhere. And this is the first time I've been like on my own in a big city. Orlando's a pretty big city. Yeah. And so I do the police report and stuff. They come and whatever. I end up going back to my apartment complex, walk back. And obviously it's like 5 a.m. So my boys are still sleeping. My buddies are still sleeping. So I'm not going to wake them up. So I go in the apartment, I grab my trunks. My swim trunks, and I decided to go back. We had like a community, you know, those apartment complexes have community pools and stuff. Right. So I go in the hot tub and stuff, just chill out until my boys wake up so I can tell them about what happened. And lo and behold, when I go to the pool, Barry Houston's there with, he was dating a girl that happened to be living in the same complex, in the apartment complex. And he was, I want to say he was drunk and drinking and stuff because he was really, really outgoing now. And he's like, you know, and now I have my shirt off and I've always been genetically like, you know, pretty lean and stuff. So he looks at me, he goes, man, you have a good body. And I was like, yeah. And I told him what happened. I just got held up and stuff. And he goes, see, he goes, you know what? You could have, anything could have happened tonight. You know, he goes, I tell you what, he goes, how would you feel about trying out to be a wrestler? And I was like, don't tell me about it. He told me about the power plant. And he told me, he goes, you know what? If you want to try out the power plant, it's every month in Atlanta. You go, it's 3 days of strenuous, like, you know, physical activities. They try to, like, you know, try to wean you out, get you to quit. But if you can make it, you know, it might be something you know. But I was pretty adamant. Now I'm a basketball player. But I'll try, you know, I decided, I gained a report from him. And he goes, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, it's actually today. You know, it was like 5 a.m. I said, the cops, I guess, are supposed to come over the police, you know, they're going to do they're going to do one of those composite drawings of the people that robbed me. And then after that, nothing. I'm free. And he goes, I'm going to invite you down to Universal Studios. That's where they used to, at Universal Studios. You're probably there too.
Oh yeah.
You used to tape those, I think the Saturday Night Show, was it maybe?
It was Worldwide.
Okay.
Yeah. Worldwide with the big ones there. I'm sure there probably some more.
Pro, I think.
Pro. There you go. That's it.
Yeah. So I basically, he invited me down there. And, so I went down there and stuff. And, you know, the crazy thing is when I went backstage, like, it was kind of like a time warp because, you know, I just told you, the era that I liked was that, you know, the Hillbilly Jim, the Big John Studd, Hulk Hogan, Bruce the Barber Beefcake, Rick Rude and Kurt Hennig were my favorites, you know, like, so. Now I go backstage at WCW, fast forward all these years. Now all those big stars from WWF are now with WCW under Turner. So I'm going backstage like a kid in the candy store. I'm seeing this.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This guy I watched when I was a kid, I'm seeing, you know, Bruce the Barber Beefcake, he was a different character now, but he was in the NWO. But I've seen guys I saw growing up, and I was like, oh my God, that's Rick Rude. You know, he had a suit on. And that's Kurt Hennig. You know, like, I was like, it was crazy. And then I remember Barry introduced me to everybody. He introduced me to Booker T and Stevie Ray. And I remember Booker saying, don't hurt nobody, Mark, you know, when he heard I was going to try out the power plant. So it was cool. I met Sarge and, I basically, Barry said, hey, Sarge, this is Mark. He's going to be trying out at the school next month. And he goes, do your effing squats. He didn't say hello. He said, do your effing squats. And, you know, basically he introduced me to everyone. And then I just kind of wanted to get going. I don't want to be like in the way of anything. So it was enough for me. I had already had I met like people that I were like idolized as a kid. So it was crazy, you know, and so I was leaving off the lot to go back to my, you know, basically I was going to grab a taxi and go home. as I'm walking out, this black Mercedes rolls up and he rolls down the window, and it was Macho Man. And he pulled his glasses down and he goes, "Ooh," he looked at me and he goes, "Ooh, I thought you were Alex Wright," you know, and he rolled the window back up and he just drove back in, you know, towards the building. And that was like the cherry on the cake. You know, I met everybody. I'm leaving. I don't meet him, but he thinks I'm Alex Wright. I see Macho Man, you know, his voice sounded like the Macho Man. It was amazing. It was like a blast from the past. And literally leaving there, I said, you know what? I'm going to try out. Like, you know, these things sometimes in life, you know, I'm a pretty spiritual guy. I go to church a lot and stuff. And I believe things happen for reasons. I always look for signs. I always look for, you know, strange little like things, in, you know, along my path. And this jumped out at me. So I actually went, you know, Barry paid my tryout as well. I was a kid, didn't have much money or anything. He paid for my tryout. He was just like, you know, just one day pay it forward to somebody else, you know, and help somebody else, you know. And basically I went to the power plant tryout somewhere, I think in 1998. I didn't go back to school. I just decided I'm going to quit school. I'm going to become a wrestler. And I went, when I tried out, 26 guys were at my tryout. And, you know, they tortured guys. And a lot of guys had the wrong impression. They came in all like 280, 290, all blown up. Not their cardio wasn't good. They thought they were looking for muscle heads. I was, you know, I was slender. I had a good body. Like I had to grow into my body, my frame, but like I was slender and very efficient, agile, and had a lot of endurance. And that was what's needed in those tryouts, because you do squats and then you go outside and you run. And, you know, so I made it 26 guys, three made it. At the end of like within hours, there was only three of us left within hours. And they couldn't tell you to leave. They wouldn't tell you to leave, because if they told you to leave, they had to give back their $300 trial fee. So all these people quit on their own, which is crazy, you know? And so after I passed that tryout and Jody Hamilton, who was ahead of the power plant at the time and invited me to come back to the camp, he said, you know, like your endurance, your agility, you need to put some weight on, but you got a good look, you're young. He's like, I'd love to have you come back to the camp, you know, and try to be a wrestler. And I ended up quitting school, like I said, and basically saved some money and moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And that was a wrap. Yep. Wow.
What a story, man. That's amazing.
Sorry if it was a little long-winded.
No, I was hanging on every word. I don't know about you, Brian. I'm sure. I mean, through looking at your face, we were all engrossed in it. That was a sensational story. I'm actually traveling to Orlando next year. I'm visiting it. So I'm going to go get a picture in Denny's by SeaWorld. We're going to love it. I'm going to see if you're still employee of the month, because after that, I guarantee
I definitely wasn't employee of the month. I made a lot of errors. You know, it was hard for me to carry trays. It was just awkward. It was awkward. It was, you know, but
it was the gateway, brother. It was the gateway to an incredible career.
Yep.
So you said you've obviously given us the initial start of the power plant, and you mentioned there were three of you left. Can you remember who the other two were?
The other two guys didn't come back. Like, they never, you know, one was I don't remember the names. They never came back.
They never came back. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's especially in like the 80s and 90s, it was all about weeding out the ones who aren't going to perform, who can't pick this lifestyle. And knowing you were the one shining light, that must hold a significant place. But Sarge holds a massive place in our hearts, as he does in English folklore as well. I don't know whether or not you were actually around for the shooting of the Louis Theroux show.
I was not. Gosh, I think I was there, but I see the video all the time, and I don't see myself on video, but I remember it because, like, that guy, we tortured him. It was, I mean, not tortured, but like, it was like,
oh, you should have tortured him. You should have, yeah, I mean, you really should have.
It was still all about protecting the business back then, you know, and like, and from going through this torturous, like, tryout, and like, and every month it was the same thing, 3 days, June, and every time it was like a cycle. All the ones that made the tryout, now we're on the other side. Now we're on Sarge's side. Now we're getting in the face of everybody, you know? And like, it's crazy because we ran off a lot of people, you know, like that basically quit. You know, there's a story that Batista talks about in his book where he basically quit, you know, very quickly too. You know, he was one of those guys that came in, not good cardio, and he quit. So there's a you know, a lot of people. Bob Sapp. I don't know if you remember Bob Sapp.
Oh, yeah.
Sapp, you know, in Japan, he I remember he was doing like squats, and he got sick, and he run into the garbage can. He puked in front of himself. So he slipped on his own puke and crashed into the garbage. It was like, that's the kind of stuff that would happen. And I think a lot of times us young guys, we rub people who tried out the wrong way, because that's all we knew. It was a different kind of, with Sarge and the power play, it was like a reputation of being like very, very hard. You know, like we always had these cameras coming in, camera crews, you know, Dateline and 60 Minutes and all the, you know, and every time it was a new, like, that's what we pushed, you know, like we're tip top shape and that's why sometimes, like, you know, the power plant, we were in really good shape, but like sometimes I wish that, you know, maybe we did a lot of calisthenics. We were in really good shape, but we're still very green. So a lot of times we got moved up, the big show, like, you know, you know, Brian, because yeah. you and Brian worked Palumbo and Stasiak a lot and me and yeah. O'Hare a lot. And, you know, so, but when we were very green, you know, you guys helped lead us and give us pointers every match, you and Hugh Morris and your partner, Brian, of course, and guys like Alex Wright and Billy Kidman and stuff. So it was great times. I mean, you know, we were all in great shape, had great bodies and stuff. I wish we were a little less green, but you know, like you got to take the chance when you get it. Yeah. And that little 6 month spurt of us being on TV kind of got us seen by the wrestling public and got us picked up fairly quickly. Like, you know, Stasiak, Palumbo, myself, like we're all very quickly getting picked up by WWE because we weren't like, we didn't have those big contracts. We're all young. We're all 6'6", you know, all 250 pounds. So, it all worked out in our favor. You know, that's why, like, I can never say anything bad. I know Vince Russo gets a bad rap here and there, but I can never say anything bad about him because he gave us our opportunity, you know? So you remember the hand that feeds you throughout your wrestling career.
Yeah. He helped put Chronic together. So yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And we're very much a positive show. So we like to shine the spotlight where we can on the positive side. We raise that roof. We are all about the light side of the ring, as opposed to 90% of the podcasts out there. Yeah. That like to sensationalize the dark side of the ring. So it's what we're about here on The Meltdown. So when it comes to the Natural Born Thrillers, was it easier coming up as part of a group that were all in a very similar situation?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we were really lucky. I always say it was like for the Natural Born Thrillers, it's almost like changing schools, going to a new school for the first time. Would you be better off going to the school if you're just by yourself, or you end up moving schools, but you have five of your best friends with you, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we got to stick together. We probably got a lot of heat from the older guys, you know, because we were all young and joyful and exuberant, you know, and just ready to take on the world. But it was great, you know, like getting moved up all together. It was just so much easier. So much easier. Like, I know I had a better time adjusting and getting to the big time with that safety net, you know, having a partner like O'Hare or it was great. It was, I can't put into words how wonderful it was to be alongside your friends in that atmosphere, you know, because we're in the power plant and the next thing you know, we're in the big show with Chronic and with Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash, NWO and all those luchadors, you know, like it was intimidating, but like it was less intimidating because we had our crew.
Yeah. That's that. I would think that moving, like you said, moving up to the next level, to the big show, would definitely feel better if you had your friends or guys that you started in the business with. That totally makes sense to me. Let me ask you this, Mark. How about the WCW Tag Team Championships? Let's discuss, you know, your work within the division and what it meant for you to have a run as two-time WCW Tag Team Champions.
It was really important for me because, I never end up winning a belt in WWE. So as far as my, like, United States accolades, you know, it's always nice to be a two-time champion. And the greats that have worn the belts, like you guys, like Chronic, like, Palumbo and Stasiak were tag team partners. Even the old tag teams, the Booker T and Stevie Ray, you know, like, it was – you know, I looked through the long one at one point in time. I looked at all the past champions, and it was great to be part of that, you know, that history, you know. And But yeah, I took it very seriously, and again, with Sean O'Hare, like we started together, and we put together a little tag team, just from nothing, organically put a tag team together. Our styles worked really well together because I was still kind of young and naive but fresh, and he was a little older, and he was kind of like a man child. He was a strong, vicious dude, looking dude. So it was a great contrast, and just an athletic guy. He's what a crazy athletic guy, Sean
Oh,
O'Hare.
I remember him doing the spin kicks and just always on point with everything he did.
Yeah, it
Great,
was
great with
amazing.
martial arts. Yeah, really
Yep.
great athletic. Yes, no doubt.
Brilliant talent, sensational look, incredible in-ring. And as we do each week here on the Meltdown, we do like to send a big shout out upstairs to fallen heroes. So, Sean
Yep.
O'Hare, this one is for you, brother. Cheers, cheers.
Definitely.
There we go. So, from your beautiful beginnings in WCW, we come to that fateful night on the.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
26th of March 2001, when it is announced that the WWE have acquired the rights to WCW. Now, through doing my research, I understand you were actually the first match on that card in Panama City Beach, Florida, rocking
Yeah.
in a dark match. What was it like amongst the boys, amongst the crew on that particular day when you see Shane McMahon and Bruce Pritchard and the rest of the WWE staff rock up? Was there any kind of team meeting that day?
Not really. Not us young guys. I mean, at least for me, and like I remember the guys I was hanging around with that day, like a lot of the WCW stuff was not a blur, but like it was so new to us. It was like you just kind of went with the flow, like I did know, like I did feel like when it was all going down that kind of happy. I thought a big opportunity might be on its way, like a new company taking over. And I, like again, I felt confident because I know we weren't making the big money and stuff. I mean, from a company standpoint, if you're taking over another company, like I said, we got signed fairly quickly, just because our contracts were still very modest, all young, all fresh, all like we're kind of like moldable clay,
That's what I was going to
like
say, moldable,
we
yeah.
had all the girth. Now you just got to kind of sculpt us, and that was kind of like I thought that they would think that of us, because I knew they were big on. At that time, they're developmental. They're developing stars like the Hardy Boys, like the Kurt Angles and stuff, coming out of their territories. Like I think Memphis and then they had Louisville, of course, and HWA in Cincinnati. So they did a good job of getting guys ready, and that's ultimately what happened when a lot of us like O'Hare and myself, when we got there, the WWE they put us in that camp. In OVW to basically kind of mold us, and that camp in itself is like historical, like every day, Batista, Lesnar, Orton, Cena, me and O'Hare, Charlie Haas, Shelton Benjamin, the list goes on. I mean, ton of the Bastion brothers, pretty much everyone that came up, like young guys from in WWE from 2002 to like 2005 were in that camp, like we. Little by little, all of us got moved up, in one shape or form, So yeah, I wasn't, a lot of other guys were worried about things, or wondering what the future's like, but being young, I didn't have I just went with the flow. I went with the flow and figured
Go
it's
with
gonna be
it.
okay. It's gonna be okay. I'll figure it out, I'll figure it out. And it ended up working out okay.
I think it worked out all right. You smashed it. Absolutely smashed it.
Yeah, you mentioned Panama City and going out there. I was out with a concussion. Full disclosure, I have no idea what happened on at that show. I mean, of course, I would watch the tapes and stuff later, but yeah, man, I was out. But I remember watching it at home, like, okay, something's happening here, something big. So yeah.
What was Brian's opinion, as in Brian Adams, that you were in contact with him?
So we both had already been there. So we knew what that 290, 300 days of the year, we knew what that grind was about. We knew what that pay scale was about. And we, like I said, we mentioned earlier, we were already under a contract. So there was no rush for us to make a decision.
Yeah.
And we did have the options of Japan and other places. So we just sort of was sitting it out for a little while, which was okay.
Yeah. I'd have done the same thing. Well, taking a look down the line, we're going to come to, as we have everything scripted here, we like to mold everything. As Mark just said, you were moldable. We're moldable here on the Meltdown. So I'm going to mold you in to a scenario where after the acquisition, you were actually seen on screen at WrestleMania 17 up in the skybox. Was there an original plan for the WCW wrestlers to be involved, or was it just that shot?
I don't like it. Like, we weren't even in contact with anyone. Like, basically they just brought us there. We went straight up there, and when we left, like, we didn't go down in the locker room or anything. So it was still, like I said, it was still kind of weird.
Does sound weird. Not going down to the locker room to see the boys. But I see your point, because I remember how divided things were as far as WCW guys going into that.
Yeah. Yeah. And Lions Den. And that was like, you know, so we didn't really have, that wasn't, I didn't feel like that was a true representation of knowing the WWE guys, because we didn't know them. And it was kind of weird. They panned over and you really couldn't see anybody, but you just said, oh, those are the WCW guys. The first time we started doing some kind of invasion, it was at another pay-per-view. And that was a little more intimidating, because it was, you know, all of us, at least O'Hare, myself, Palumbo, you know, like we're still like, not, we're very like playful and young still and stuff. And like when you got to WWE, like the locker room was a lot more serious, very serious business. It was like, you know, and you had there were certain things about shaking hands and like, you go to catering and someone's talking, like, and you have to make these decisions. Like it was stressful. Like, do I interrupt and say, hey, Triple H, or hey, so-and-so, or do I wait till they're done talking and maybe risk looking like a, you know, stuck up, or, you know, or not very giving of my hand, you know, well, I don't know. Like it was weird. That was the weird thing. Because I barely understood the politics in WCW, and I was there, you know, on TV for a little bit before they shut down. So I didn't understand the politics of the locker rooms, you know, like definitely not in WWF at the time. But again, we still, you know, we still had our crew of friends still there. You know, O'Hare was there and Palumbo was there. And I want to say Stasiak was there too. I think Stasiak originally came over too. So, you know, Stasiak's always a little comic relief, you know. Shout out to Sean Stasiak.
Hey, Stasiak blows my phone up all the time. We go back and forth. So, yeah, he is very entertaining, to say the least. We'll definitely get him on. We'll get him on here sooner or later. But, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Always a good time with Stasiak.
Yeah, so basically that was, you know, it was just weird. It was a weird experience. And, again, it was nothing I could ever compare it to. So we just kind of went with it, and, you know, and that was about it, you know.
Okay.
Well, with hindsight being 2020, and I'm going to ask this to both of you who were in the situation of the invasion, what would you guys have done differently if you were in a position of being able to book the show and book WCW coming into and onto WWE TV? Would you have done anything differently? Would you have extended it? Do you think it was too quick and fizzled out too fast?
You can go first, Mark. I'll listen.
You know, I think it was just from the point in time that Shane McMahon showed up on WCW television to the invasion, it was like so... It was like almost so much, you couldn't even, it was such a, there's just so much going on, you know,
like a whirlwind. It was just
before you could even wrap your head. Yeah, before you could even wrap your head around, like, oh my God, Shane McMahon was just on TNT and WCW television. Before you could wrap your head around that, now, you know, one of the next events we had that was big was in Atlanta, and this was crazy. And I think they worked it pretty well because they ended up taking like five WWEers. I think it was like Big Show and APA and Bob Holly, and maybe they had their fifth or whatever, you know. And then their WCW was like myself, I think O'Hare, Palumbo. It was like five of us. And at the end of the show, we kind of just started like the whole setup of the show was like WCW versus WWE. And we were fighting at the end, a big, you know, 10-way going on, just fighting. And all of a sudden, coming from the stands comes Paul Heyman and all of ECW. And they enter the ring. They enter the whole forum of everything. And nobody knows what's going to happen. And what happens is they join side with us, and we beat the crap out of them. And that kind of like forms the whole, you know, faction,
ECW,
the Alliance, WCW, ECW. And I thought that was cool. I thought it was cool. But it's just, you know, it's hard. You know, it was so much going on. Like, because, you know, yeah, all this talent, and now you've only got a few shows, to set things up and get everyone on TV and not completely shut down the WCW talent, give them a little shine, but also not like step on any WWE talent. Like it was just like weird times. And but I think what they did, to look back on it now, some of the things they did were pretty cool, you know. And I think they did the best job they could with it. And I couldn't really add anything that would make it better or worse. But you know, I liked how they did it.
Cool, Brian. What do you think?
I think they had the opportunity for almost like a Super Bowl of pro wrestling, you know, company versus company. But you also had guys that were sitting on those Turner, TBS, WCW contracts that were not going to move. So then that would delay things a year, 2 years, depending on how long guys were tied up for. So it was just almost impossible to put all the pieces together to make it work. So that's sort of what I take from it. And, you know, and again, some guys were going to Japan. Some guys were staying at home. Some guys were ready to retire. Some guys should have retired. It was just a big variety. So it could have went a lot of different ways.
Yeah. And also I want to say this is like, because a lot of the guys like yourself or Kevin Nash or Booker, you know, or Booker T was there, I think. Certain guys that did have those contracts, that's maybe one thing I would have changed. And, you know, I'm glad that I got the opportunity to be part of that little invasion, you know, and the back and forth rivalry there. But it probably would have been better suited if you guys, like I just told you, like our team was like, it was, I think it was like Canyon, me, O'Hare, Palumbo, Stasiak. I don't know. Say those five, right?
Right.
It was a good, I mean, we were going against that team. I told you Big Show and Bob Holly and APA and stuff, but like it probably would have been better if some of the more veteran guys, like now take out us five and put Chronic, Kevin Nash, maybe Booker T and somebody else, you know, that now you got five veterans and five bona fide like stars. You know, we were still on the rise. Like we were just young. We got a little like a moment in the sun towards the end of WCW, you know. So And I think a lot of people either were WCW faithful or WWE faithful. It seemed like a lot of times, like, they were very separate when we got over there, you know? Like, and so I think maybe, even though I'm glad I got the chance to participate, it would have probably been better for
T. At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It'd be wise if the veterans had that, formed that alliance, like more veterans that, you know, they had those contracts and just sitting home, like, you know, it'd be silly not to, you know, sit at home, you know? So,
yeah.
But that's all.
It could have been booked a million different ways. We know that, especially, you know, playing you know, the quarterback position and looking at it a week later going, oh, we should have done this or that. There's a million ways to go with it. I want to ask you about this. After you left OVW and you had got even more seasoned, more training under your belt. Let's see here. Well, let me go back to that. Who were your trainers? Just out of curiosity, who were some of your trainers there? Do you remember?
Trainers
at OVW.
OVW, that would be Danny Davis and Rip Rogers. Shout out, Rip Rogers is really good. He was, and then Cornette was, he was more of like, he was there on TV days talking more like angles and stuff like that, like how he wanted TV run. But on the daily basis, it was Danny Davis and Rip Rogers. And, you know, we had some veterans in that class too, like Nick Densmore, AKA Eugene. Like he was a really good worker and he would lead us through drills and things of that sort. You know, so we had a good little camp, and Danny Davis was great. Rip Rogers is, you know, elite as a teacher, you know, like really like some people like we talked about Sarge earlier, like Sarge, like all the respect in the world, love Sarge. But like sometimes he was, as a young guy, it was hard to learn from him because he was so much the whole in your face sometimes is tough. This is wrestling, you know, you're taking bumps. Every time you fall, you're landing awkward or taking a, you, like you're a little like cautious, you know? And when you got somebody like Rip Rogers that explains it to you calmly and says, all right, do it again. No, you did this, do it this way. You know, like it's a lot better than get up, puke, do it again. You know? And you're like, all right, I just fell high on my neck. Like, give me a sec, you know, like.
Shake it off, right?
Yeah. So like, I think that's where a lot of us learned to work a lot better as at that camp. It was, like I said, like we were all pretty much young and ready to take over the world. Like, you know, you had Lesnar and Cena, the Orton, some of the biggest stars of the wrestling for the next 20 years, you know? So it was just a great camp. And we pushed ourselves every day because it was one of those things, like everyone was in that camp and guys were getting moved up little by little. Like, and it was the whole thing. Who's getting moved up next, you know? And then somebody would get moved up, like Lesnar would get moved up and like, okay, now who's going to, you know, like it was almost like who's going to come out next? Because it seemed like they had plans of really like giving all the young guys a chance, you know, at least give one chance, you know? And so it was a good time. It was a great time in my career.
Well, speaking of the move up, you did move up beautifully to the Raw roster, where we've learned that you were going to be in the original lineup of Evolution.
Yeah.
So when did you learn about this? What was going through your mind when you were told that you were going to be brought into this faction with Triple H and Ric Flair and Randy Orton? And ultimately, what led to the pivot away from you?
Well, simply, you know, like when I was at the OVW, you know, Orton and I started becoming friends and we'd hit the weights together, diet together and stuff and go out, you know, have some beers, party and stuff. So it was like, we became friends and you know, a lot of people at OVW saw that and, you know, word travels fast that Triple H wants to make a faction and stuff. And, Vince included me, you know, so they flew me up to Stanford and basically they brought me in like this boardroom and stuff. And they told me what they were going to do. And that was, you know, they said it was going to go on soon and, just be ready. So, in that time when they told me it in Stanford, you know, like we started filming vignettes and stuff, you know, all the vignettes that came out afterwards that I was part of the group. You know, it felt weird. But number one, Orton and I were young, okay? I think I was maybe like 24 or 25. He was maybe 22 or 23. We were young and super, super immature. And the problem was we were getting in trouble a lot. But like the difference is like I was a guy who came over from WCW, you know? And Orton is a guy that his family name has been rich in tradition in WWF history, you know? His dad, his granddad wrestled. So he's third generation. It was like, you know, like every time we get in trouble and stuff or, you know, like Triple, there was a time when Triple H would, you know, rent a car and Flair would be there in the front seat and me and Orton in the back seat, the Lincoln Town car. And Triple H would want to talk about wrestling and, you know, X's and O's, you know, like when you make that hot tag or when not to, you know, when the people are going to, you know, he wanted to talk about that building towards that group. because it hadn't been like Orton was already in. It was like Flair, Triple H, and Orton, but I was going to be the fourth member. So we'd travel and stuff together, and it ended up turning into like Ric Flair wanting to hear about me and Randy's, you know, going out and who we were meeting and stuff. And it, you can tell like it rubbed Triple H the wrong way. And even on some documentaries and stuff like Ruthless Aggression, he talks about it, how he wanted to throw me and Orton off a bridge. So basically that's what happened. Basically, in a nutshell, we played around too much. They wanted to make a serious faction. Me and Orton equally got in trouble, but I ultimately got in trouble because he was kind of like their baby. He was grown in WWF. His father wrestled in WWF. It was a no-brainer, you know? So they moved me over to SmackDown. Or actually, first they moved me in a tag team with Garrison Cade. And they just basically, Vince told me, I remember it was in Madison Square Garden backstage, and he told me, like, yeah, we feel it might be better to not put you in a group. And besides all that, the immaturity, I remember too, like, every like week on Raw leading up to the who's going to be the fourth member, they're really hyping it up, like having polls and stuff, like who's going to be, you know, I can recall Jerry Lawler, you know, who's going to be the fourth member, you know, and they'll show like a little like poll. They got like Jericho, they got Kevin Nash or someone, you know, like big, like established veteran names. Test, is it going to be, you know, like, is it going to be Test? It could be Jericho. Is it going to be, you know, and I saw that and I started getting worried because I'm like, man, this is a lot to live up to, because if I'm the fourth member, the fans are going to be expecting like someone like a Chris Jericho or somebody like a surprise or someone like some. So I got kind of worried. I'm like, you know what, if it did go through and I was going to be the fourth member, it might have gotten kind of, it might have been tough for me, you know, as well, because like I said, again, a lot of the WWE fans weren't WCW fans, and at least not towards the end, you know, towards the end of WCW a lot of times. So I felt as if, like, even though I had some time in WCW and ex-tag team champion and stuff, still on the wrestling radar, we were still little blips, you know? Like, so I just felt like even if they did go move forward with it, it might not have worked. It might not have worked as well as it did with a Batista or someone, you know, a fresh new face or someone that hadn't had history before. So that, you know, for whatever reason, whether the immaturity or just like the overhype, you know, I learned a valuable lesson, you know, like you know, you can't mess around and stuff. You know, when people take business very seriously, like they don't want some young guy messing it up, you know? So I took, you know, basically I stayed around WWE for a little while longer. Like I said, I was with Garrison Cade with a tag team. I moved over to SmackDown. I was a Reflection of Perfection with Teddy Long as my manager for a while. And then I was with Kurt Angle's group with Luther Reigns and Kurt Angle for a while. But it never reached the maximum like it would have been with Evolution, you know? So it was like, but basically I learned my lesson, you know? I got taken out of that group and like but you know, fast forwarding when I eventually went to, you know, Mexico, you know, like we'll talk about that. Yeah. You know, like I learned to take business a lot more seriously, you know, and I'll tell you, I'm a little more mature now, but like even like up to till I got to Mexico, I was very immature and just like, you know, just still so young and young acting and young minded. And I still kind of am today, and I'm glad because I'm almost 50 years old, but in my mind, I'm still 25, you know, so that's great. But like, but just the Evolution thing, it was an error on my part. It was, we messed around too much. We prioritized like hanging out and going out more than we did like wrestling, you know, and Triple H didn't want somebody prioritizing going out, you know. Ric Flair already had that gimmick, you know, so he didn't need me and Orton following suit, you know. So, and a lot of times what would happen is when I'd be on the house show loop and me and Orton and Flair and Triple H travel together, they couldn't get Orton focused, you know? But when I wasn't on the loop and it was just Orton, Flair, and Triple H, Orton was a lot more focused. He didn't have me there goofing off and stuff. So that was ultimately the decision, the bouncement of the group. And like I said in the documentary, like, rightfully so. Like, I wasn't ready for it, you know? So
Well, and you were, like I said, at your age, you were so young, you were learning the business and still not necessarily getting your feet wet, but still you were advancing in those stages. And it takes that. You know, I learned a lot from my first run up there. I was a little bit like you were initially at the first time going out. I'd just freshly come out of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And the next thing you know, I'm in WWF. Wait a minute, you know, learning all the little politics and everything that goes along with it. So I understand exactly what you went through there.
Yeah.
And a shout out, by the way, you mentioned Luther Reigns. He is also an Arizona guy, right up the road here. Big shout out, another guy we
love, Luther. Yep, yeah, definitely.
Yes. Real quick, I want to ask you this. You tell me, when you mentioned going over to SmackDown, and how much fun did you have working with the player himself, Teddy Long? I mean, how was that?
It was great. It was great because, you know. The thing was when they created that gimmick, Reflection of Perfection, and he was my manager, we did pretty much for 3 months in a row. All I really did was we started the group, and I think I beat up Spike Dudley. I protected him from Teddy. Teddy Long was fighting Spike Dudley. I enter the ring, pulverized Spike Dudley. Teddy Long jumps in my arms, and I become the Reflection of Perfection. But, like, after that, like, they started on SmackDown, but then they put me on Velocity for literally – 3 months, the sideshow Velocity, secondary show for like literally 3 months. And I never lost. Like I was beating quality guys like Billy Guns and characters like that, like big wins over big characters. And I was the Reflection of Perfection. So I didn't lose, you know, but it never saw the light of SmackDown Day. You know, that's almost sometimes more of a bigger what if for me than Evolution, because like Teddy Long, it was good. Like
at Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
He'd be talking as I let out the ring. He'd say stuff like, I love Mark Jindrak like a fat lady love cake, you know, and stuff like that. He'd say these, you know, or, and it was fun and it was fun and stuff. And, but I wish we would have had a chance at least to try it on SmackDown, the SmackDown show, you know. It just never did. And it kind of just disappeared. Like Teddy ended up becoming like the SmackDown general manager and stuff. Yeah. And I kind of morphed into Angle's group with Luther Reigns. So, but I wish we would have gotten a chance to do that whole act with the mirror and everything on regular SmackDown television, just to see if it would have hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of a hit, you've made that move to Mexico, but before we take you on that journey down south to South America, we're going to play a little game because, as you just eloquently put, we're all a little bit immature. We all like playing games, and we love playing games here on The Meltdown. So I'm going to pose a question to both of you, as we do each and every week. We are going to ask you to give us your Mount Rushmores. And this week, Mr. Jindrak, we are going to ask you for your Mount Rushmore of best athletic big men. Give us your four top. Who is going to have their face enshrined in glory?
Okay. My first, let's see, big men. I remember when I first got the WCW, a big guy that could really fly and was really athletic, Mike Awesome. So I think that's going to be number one for me. I got to include, we talked about Sean O'Hare, so I'm going to put Sean O'Hare on there.
Yep.
Who else?
We don't make it easy, do we, Brian? We don't make it easy.
No, how you think about this one, and we understand if you put yourself on there because you could do it all, so.
No, I'm not going to put I protect my dropkick a lot.
Athletic big men. I mean, don't sell yourself short, Mark. You could do it all.
I think I got to put Lesnar. Lesnar, you know, I mean, the guy's a to go and almost play professional football and win a UFC title and just like the monster of an athlete. Like it so I got to go. Let's see. So awesome, Mike Awesome, Sean O'Hare, Brock Lesnar, and I think I'm gonna go. Man, I got one last.
That last spot. It's
I'm gonna give it. You know what? I'm gonna give it to Brian Clark.
Woo!
I'm gonna give it to Brian Clark. I remember. I remember him and Brian Adams used to do that spot. But I thought it was really. It looked really nice when Brian would do that flying shoulder tackle. Right? That's you did a flying shoulder tackle.
Yeah,
right?
I did a few things, man, off the top, off the apron. A little combination. Yeah, hey, thank you, man. I appreciate that. I don't consider myself in that group, but hey, I appreciate that.
Look at him, he's beaming from ear to ear. You've made his
game. I didn't expect that. Okay.
Right, hey, my question now is, I'm going to pose that to you as well, Brian, but I think, as we do, because we see if you marry up, I'm saying one maximum that you share.
Because if you look back at the history, and I sort of look at not just one era, I'll look at, you know, sometimes I'll look at the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 10s, you know. Okay, here we go. My four. In no particular order, Brock Lesnar.
There's the one.
Two, I'm going to go with AEW's Brian Cage.
Nice.
Another Meltdown alumnus, yes.
Number three, you got to go with The Undertaker. And four, again, I'm like Mark here. This could go a number of different ways. But I'll go back to an AEW guy he's probably 6'7". I'm thinking Lance Archer.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. But now if you go in the bigger scope and you look down into Mexico and that whole history, you got to think about Mark Jendrak. Like I said, hey, tape doesn't lie, brother. You can do it all.
Well, it was Marco Corleone. Corleone.
Well, yeah. Yep. And that's coming up next.
It's coming up next, but I'm going to give, you know what? Barry Horowitz did it the best, but I'm going to give myself a pat on the back because I got it right. I got it right. I am not staring up at the lights this week, Mr. Clark. No, we're in. We're rocking it. Well, speaking of rocking it, yes, we're going to take a trip down to Mexico and those four very important letters, CMLL. Marco Corleone.
Yes.
Just give us a full-on scoop of how you found your time in Mexico.
Well, first of all, what happened was I was released from WWE in July of 2005. So I remember, July of 2005, and I remember I got released, and they paid for 90 more days. But the thing that happened was this is young me, was so excited. Even though they had released me, I made the cut to be on the video game. And the video game royalties used to be ridiculous. And I remember I got released, but like a few weeks later, I got a huge royalty check for a video game. So that kind of like gave me time to think, you know, like time to think of what's going to go on. And I went with Matt Morgan to do some stuff in Tokyo with New Japan. And then I would go on by myself. Let me tell you how the CMLL thing started first. So I really didn't have much going on. And then in March of 2006, Johnny the Bull, Stamboli, and Chuck Palumbo went to Mexico, and they did, they were working an angle with Ultimo Dragon, and he had a dojo down there in Mexico. So they're working an angle with him and a couple of his students, his in his dojo. And that was March. And it was building towards, Ultimo Dragon for a long time had a Dragon Mania in Mexico. And Dragon Mania 1 was in May of 2006. So what had happened was when Johnny Stamboli and Chuck Palumbo did this little angle in March of 2006, when Chuck got back from Mexico, WWE had called him and rehired him because he had gotten released around the time I had gotten released. But they rehired him and repackaged him. I think he was riding a motorcycle then, motorcycle gimmick.
Yeah.
So now it's, you know, it was like April now or something. Johnny Stamboli calls me. He's like, hey, Chuck just got rehired. We're doing this gimmick, in Mexico. Do you want to come and play an Italian? You want to be part of FBI, full-blooded Italians? I was like, yeah, sure. Sure. So I was going to go there in May of 2006, and I was going to go there for Ultimo Dragon, Dragon Mania 1. But at the same time, that same weekend, CMLL, every year they would do one show, a big show they would call the Grand Prix. What it would be is they'd bring 8 foreigners in from all over the world, England, United States, and then they would face off against 8 Mexicans. So it was like a single elimination. So it was 8 on one side, 8 on the other side. It was like a Grand Prix. Just, guys just get in the ring, one guy gets in the ring, we start eliminating each other with pinfalls. And so that was my first event, Grand Prix. And I remember getting Arena Mexico. It was kind of weird. You enter through this parking deck. It's kind of like, it doesn't look too extravagant. You hear the Cathedral of Lucha Libre, Arena Mexico, and I'm there in the parking lot. It just kind of looked like kind of whack. I was like, man, this is not what I expected. But man, I'll tell you what, when I walked in that place and those crowds, especially for that Grand Prix, always drew 12,000 to 14,000 people, and I remember seeing that crowd for the first time. I was like, oh my God. Well, oh my God. I had no idea. And the funny thing was all my trunks said Mark Jindrak on it. Jindrak and this, and Reflection of Perfection, Mark Jindrak. And so I bought all Mark Jindrak trunks, but they'd called me a different name, Marco Corleone. That's how they gave me the name Marco Corleone. And I remember looking at the sheet and it said Marco Corleone. I said, Johnny, I said, I thought I'm in your match. I said, I don't see my name. And then I found out that they called me Marco Corleone, And what was kind of cool, that Grand Prix was a little easier because lo and behold, when we got there, man, the language barrier was tough. I didn't speak Spanish at the time, I had no idea. I thought Amigo was a rent a car company, I had no idea. But the great thing that happened was when I got there, I met a guy named Dos Caras Jr., aka Alberto Del Rio. In WWE, and he was bilingual, so he spoke English and he spoke Spanish, so he was great. He was on the other team, the Mexican team, obviously, but so my first time being able to have that translator there, and I immediately became friends with Alberto Del Rio and the other guy, Liz Mark. We wrestled Liz Mark, and that Grand Prix, like it was amazing. It was amazing, and I'd seen what a Friday night looks like at Arena Mexico. And then the following day we did was the Dragon Mania show. And then the following day after that, Sunday show would always be Arena Coliseo, one of their smaller shows in CMLL. And what was special about that show for the CMLL show was the show I was on, it was me, Johnny the Bull, and Great Muda. Great Muda was his first time ever in Mexico. So I was in the first match Muda had ever had in Mexico, that was kind of cool. Oh, nice, nice. Yep.
Legend.
And so that was it. But my experience for those 3 days in Mexico, when I was there, it was like, finally, I was like, this is it. Because I'll be honest, I went to Japan a lot and stuff, and I didn't do well. It was like a flip-flop for me. Like, I'd go to Japan and it was tough because when you're in Japan, it's a flip flop. Like it's 2 in the afternoon there, it's 2 in the morning here in the United States, And it's like, so any relationship I had with family or friends, like was null and void when I was in Japan. It was like, it was very lonely. And then the language barrier, one thing is Spanish, there's a lot of words. There's like hundreds of words that are almost spelled in Spanish and in English, the same. It's just all about pronunciation. That's not the same in speaking Japanese. Japanese language is very difficult compared to speaking Spanish. So it was like a weighing all these things out. And like, I was like, man, I want to come and live in Mexico. Like, and that's what I started doing. I started doing like little three week tours. I went to the president of CMLL at the time. His name was Paco Alonso, and rest in peace. He passed away a few years back, but
at Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I told him I want to come back and live here, and so he welcomed me with open arms, you know, and the rest is history. Like, basically, you know, as a lot of foreigners do when you go over to Mexico, you come over as a heel, or rudo, as they call it. In Mexico, they call it rudo is for the heel, and técnico was babyface. You know, I came over as that big American, you know, well, actually, the big, they thought I was Italian, Marco Corleone. And basically, you know, because I had like an athletic brand of wrestling, like I did a lot of athletic moves, it was a perfect mix for my, for where I wanted to continue my career. You know, like, and I didn't like wrestling so much in Japan, because those tours got to be long, you know, they got to be really long. And sometimes you felt like you were out in the middle of nowhere. And, it didn't seem like it was a lot of opportunity for me to get over in Japan. I didn't connect with the people. I don't know what it was. I just didn't connect. But like when I went to Mexico, I connected so well with the people, and it was kind of fitting, because my last run in before I got released from my contract when I was on SmackDown, I traveled for like a year with Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, you know? So they were my riding partners for a long time on SmackDown. And it was kind of crazy. I told you, I knew absolutely no Spanish at all. And I was still immature. So we'd, you know, after shows and stuff, I'd be in the back seat, and Eddie and Ray would be calling their families, talking Spanish. And I'd be, you know, mimicking them. Hola, ¿cómo estás? You know, and lo and behold, who knew that a few years later, I was going to just completely be thrown into the Mexico, you know, scene, and you know, and basically learn Spanish. Like, I took it very seriously. Like, I remember times being in these hotels in Mexico with flashcards. I'd test myself on words, on verbs, you know. Like, it was awesome. I took it very seriously. I saw a big chance of not only getting over, but becoming a big star, you know. Like, everyone, we all have big, you know, aspirations and stuff. And in WWE, imagine that. Like, my time in WWE, first of all, my first riding partner was Randy Orton. He became one of the biggest icons in wrestling, okay? Then I'm traveling with Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, you know? Like, I mean, two legends, two absolute legends, you know? So I saw everything they did, you know, all the accolades they accomplished, and I just wasn't accomplishing that, you know? Like, I wasn't on that level, and I had aspirations for that. When I got released from WWE, I was like, man, like, I was right there, and I could almost feel it. I could almost taste it. But, like, you know, very few become mainstream stars out of wrestling. There's only a handful, you know. It didn't happen for me in WWE. But, like, when I saw the way that he treated wrestlers in Mexico, I mean, they treated, like, Lucha Libre like a sport. Like literally – I'd wrestle on a Friday night, and Saturday morning you'd open the sports page and you'd see like a picture of me doing like a flying plancha or something, or a flying body cross body, yeah. On the, you know, front news. And they'd cover this Lucha Libre like it was a real sport. And I loved it. I was like, man, there's storylines. And I just didn't like working like independence and stuff. It seemed like, it was just one show by one show. There was no build-ups. There's no angles. There's no like consistency. You wrestled different guys every time, and it was like, man, I didn't want that. Like, I didn't get into wrestling to work in like little gyms and stuff, and in bingo halls and stuff. I became a wrestler because I wanted to wrestle in Staples Center and in big arenas, cathedrals like Madison Square Garden, Arena Mexico. You know, I wanted to wrestle in front of crowds of 15,000. You know, not. You know, so it was like a no-brainer. Like, it was just no-brainer. I was in love with it right from the get-go. And I asked to stay. And the owner at the time, the president of CMLL, he got me an apartment. He got me settled. And the rest is history. I owe CMLL everything. Because in my time in CMLL, just little by little by little by little, I became a mainstream star. So I became more than a wrestling star. And that's when it's a different kind of being over. Like I've heard people like you can be over in wrestling, but then there's another thing being over in mainstream wherever you're at. And it was quite a time to be mainstream famous in Mexico because what had happened was because I saw the way they treated wrestlers, like in the glory days of cinema and stuff, some of their biggest stars on movie theaters were Blue Demon and Santo, so they valued the wrestler, the luchador, like a lot of people on their mantle at home, they have pictures of Mary, Jesus Christ, and then they got a picture of like Santo, like heroes, mil máscaras and names of that sort. So I was like, so not only are you a wrestler now, like in where I just came from, WWE at the time, like there's very at the time it's more bigger now, but the only mainstream stars, mainstream, like on both sides of the fence, were pretty much The Rock and maybe like later on Cena, or Stone Cold on something. But it's Stone Cold, it was mainly wrestling, like he did some acting stuff, but like and Hogan, but like it was a very select few people that did the movies, like. And when I saw that what how they treated wrestlers, the luchadors in Mexico, I was like, man, I'm on board, and I took it very seriously. I studied, I like my chance I had in Evolution, like this is where I learn and grow. I messed up my chances in that, but later on in life, when I had another chance to come to Mexico and see, I could legitimately get over. And it seemed like every Friday there was crowds of 12 to 15,000 people. Because also the time in Mexico at that time in CMLL, there was a star named Místico, and he was like a mega star. He was like the next coming of Santo, and so he drew every Friday huge, huge houses, And the great thing about it is in Mexico, a lot of the matches are 3-on-3, so it'd be three technicals or babyfaces versus three rudos or three heels, and I would always team with this guy Místico. So my rise to like fame there grew pretty quick because people are coming to see this guy Místico who was fantastic, but guess what, they also had to see the 6-foot-6 guy that stuck out like a sore thumb that was doing all like I end up my finishing move and stuff there was that they had a ramp in CMLL, like a it was like a ramp to the ring, and I
Oh, yeah.
used that as like a takeoff, like a airplane takeoff, and I used to run down that ramp and jump over the top ropes like almost like in a crossbody style and just like knock people out like bowling pins, He got over. They started calling me the Italian Eagle and stuff, the Aguila Italiana, and I started seeing it all come together. It was weird because in WWE, I just couldn't. I had times, like I said, I had moments where I thought it was going to happen and it didn't happen, or I thought it was going to happen and I just, I didn't work things the right way. But in Mexico, it was like everything I was doing was just hitting. Like it was hitting. Like now I had a fantastic finisher that everybody wanted to see. When I would step out on that ramp and I'd hold my hand out like I was gonna fly like a bird, everybody got hyped up, and I would run and jump and do that crossbody, and I got over with that, in the wrestling sense, I got over. So, and then also I was different, like in WWE, there's a lot of guys that are 6'6" and above. I'm talking to one of them right now, I might have been like the 12th or 13th biggest guy on the roster at one point in time, but in Mexico, like I stuck out like a sore thumb, like almost like I was very recognizable. I became very recognizable in Mexico because wrestling, Lucha Libre was hot at the time, and now you're getting a guy that you just injected into the culture of Mexico who's 6'6". Now I got a crazy move. They're calling me Marco Corleone, the Aguila Italiana. I had monikers. Then I started doing TV appearances. So then when I started doing TV appearances, I thought to myself, man, it didn't happen for me in WWE, but like, man, I can get into this soap opera. I can get into this little acting thing. And I started getting into like little act, like they'd give me like starring roles because I became famous in the ring because they would honor and respect the people in the ring that got over. Like they just honored, wrestling was part of their culture. So I was very lucky. And, it's just that's what happened. I was getting more over in the ring, and then I was learning more and more Spanish. So every time I learned more and more Spanish, the next time they had a role for me in the channel that I worked for a lot was called Televisa. Televisa was the big, you know, and I had goals. You know, I used to be very goal oriented. I moved to Mexico for a reason. I moved to Mexico because I saw a chance to get over and become a mainstream star. And it's crazy how driven I was, and not so much driven, but like a lot in WWE, a lot of the just sometimes I just wasn't. I was a little skeptical. I wasn't prepared. Or now I'm not. I don't have the comfort of my crew around me, the natural born thrillers anymore. I'm now by myself. Am I making the right decision? Am I doing this right? You know, am I doing this right? And it just seemed like I was making a lot of just wrong decisions in WWE. Like just for some reason I just couldn't connect to it. You know, I don't know, for one reason or another, I just could not connect. And then all of a sudden going to Mexico, it just, for some reason I had a connection to the Mexican people. Like it's no coincidence that two of my best friends upon leaving WWE were Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio. I start going to Mexico, and like they immediately, even though I'm that gringo or I'm a foreigner that's, you know, the usual heel character, they everything I was doing, like it was almost like being a heel there was, I was swimming against water, and it happened so quick. And it was like a few months before they changed me just to babyface. The crowd changed me to babyface. And what's crazy was towards the end of WWE, I tried getting in, like I started doing the Ravishing Rick, you know, hip swivel, and they would boo the hell out of me in WWE. But then I started doing it in Mexico, and I was getting like Elvis Presley type pops. Like it was ridiculous. Yeah, it was just on just a little hip swivel, that Rick Rude hip swivel. And for like, I used that for 12 years. It was my main, like anytime, like, you know, if in Mexico City too, it's like a crowd like Philadelphia. Like you can't be some pretty boy with no grit that's going to get over. You had to bring it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when like these crowds would want to boo me, you know, for doing my hip swivel, when I, like 100 men can boo, but 25 women screaming will drown you out, 100 men, you know? So I would invite it. I'd invite it for all the men to start boo. And I'd say, hold on a second. I do my Rick Roots hip swivel, and automatically.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Just a wave of women screams just completely. And it became like I started... Like Rip Rogers always used to tell me, like, wrestling's like, you got to play the fans. Like, they're you got to be the puppet master. And I started learning how to become the puppet master. You know, I was finally learning how to work in a ring, like really work, because I couldn't rely on talking in the back, or I had to go off of feeling the crowd, you know, feeling the crowd and go with it. So, I mean, Mexico on so many levels, work rate, expanding as a wrestler, maturing as a individual, like, getting out and knowing a different country, you know, like it was amazing on so many levels.
Well, I mean, you went to Mexico, you became a champion, multi-time champion. You conquered Mexico, no doubt. You got over huge. I remember, like, I'm in Arizona, so I get a lot of stuff coming in here, you know, and I could see it all. And you became a breakout a soap opera star. So, I mean, you think about it, you, like you said, you got over not just in wrestling, but you got over with the whole country, the whole, just in mainstream. And that is really, that's truly being over when you can do it outside of the wrestling ring, not your mass appeal is what I'm saying.
Well, and also, like, let me put this note in, like I said, like the plan was to eventually, I wanted to get into like these soap operas, because these soap operas are on primetime television on Televisa, like 8 o'clock. And this was before streaming. So like it was pre-television. And in Mexico, not everyone has cable. In fact, the majority don't have cable, you know? And so this soap opera I got on, it was called, I got a soap opera, it was called Por Qué La Mormanda. And I was supposed to be like, it was supposed to be one show. That's it. The first episode of the whole story of the soap opera. And I filmed it in Chicago. And basically the story was the lead character, I basically met him in Chicago and I was going to use him as like a mule. I was like some Russian mobster and he needed money. So I used him as a mule. I stuffed stuff in his briefcase or whatever when he, and basically got in trouble and basically sung to the police, told tattletale to the police on me. Okay. My character. So the last, it was the last scene of the first episode. It was almost like me, this first episode. And let me tell you this first episode ratings, 32, the ratings were 32 with a 56% share. So literally half of Mexico was watching the soap opera, you know? And towards the end, it was supposed to be the end of my first episode and only episode. The lawyer was in my jail cell and he goes, my name was Uri. He goes, yeah, Uri. Basically in Spanish, he told me, yeah, he sung Jesus Garcia. He told on you. He told the cops on you. So I had a line. The line was El Infeliz de Jesus Garcia, le voy a hacer picadillo. So le voy a hacer picadillo means I'm gonna make chopped meat of them. It was like kind of a weird saying. Like, so the way I said it was so peculiar that it started trending. It was, now, grant you again, I told you the ratings were 32. So like millions of people were watching this. It caught on. It started trending on Twitter in Mexico, Picadillo. It started Picadillo, like it started becoming like a craze. And the next day, the producer of the show called me. He goes, you know, in Spanish, he was like, they loved you. They loved you. The Picadillo was so, you know. So basically, what happened was, remember in the 90s when Arnold Schwarzenegger would do movies, like, and he would say these one-liners, I'll be back. Hasta la vista, baby. My phrase in this number one, this was number one soap opera novella for 6 months, number one, with those ratings of 30, 30 plus every night. And basically, the producer brought me back, and almost every like, two, second or third episode, it was on nightly on prime time. I'd be in the jail cell basically threatening someone, te voy a hacer picadillo, picadillo. And it became that picadillo, te voy a hacer picadillo, became like I'll be back, hasta la vista. It got over in Mexico like Arnold got over in America. And that was when one at that point in time, people didn't even a lot of people that saw me on television. Like in the public now, they didn't even know I was a wrestler. They thought I was just a character on the soap opera, like because soap opera would get bigger ratings than wrestling.
Yeah.
So a lot of people that were uninformed with the wrestling, they didn't even know I was a wrestler, you know? So that's what happened. And I was on that soap opera for 177 episodes, you know? So
Wow.
yeah. So what was supposed to be one episode turned into like 177 because I said something weird with my gringo accent. So and then after that, like, let me tell you, like, it was such a popular phrase that like 6 months later, I did another soap opera, and the producer had me say that line again. So I said that line again in a different, imagine if Arnold Schwarzenegger did a whole different movie and he started saying, I'll be back also in that movie. That's what they're doing. Like I'd be in the streets and people would yell from streets away, like, Corleone, Picadillo. You know, they'd put their own accent on it, you know. So it was a magical time. And like,
Wow.
you know, and when you're over mainstream, it was like everything in the wrestling ring is like, man, it was a great time. I had never in my career been over. I'd see a lot of people. I've been in the ring with a lot of people that are over, from the Randy Orton's to the Triple H's to the Ric Flair's, the Eddie Guerrero's, Rey Mysterio's, but I had never felt that being over for me, you know, my pop. This is my and I started feeling that, like, and it was truly one of the greatest feelings I've ever had, like, in my life and professional career. I mean, when I got over, that's when I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. I started doing things like I saw my friends doing WWE. The guys are over, you know, like Eddie Guerrero wrote a book. I wrote a children's book in Mexico. I wrote a children's book about bullying, you know, and published it. You know, I always wanted to be on those big game shows like WWE wrestlers were, like the Family Feud. I was on Family Feud Mexico, you know, like I started doing everything. I had my own cologne. A company came to me and
Wow.
they made my own cologne. It was called Strong Mind. And like things would pop off, like,
Yeah.
you know, just simple things. Like I went to just a simple like people they'd invite me to like these things. One day, I forget what date it was, in Mexico, it was like they have a Day of the Mujer, Day of the Woman's Day. Basically, you know, there's Mother's Day, there's Father's Day, but this was Day of the Woman. Okay, so they'd have all these functions and stuff where like, and they had this function at like a hotel, like a Nikko hotel, and they had some other men speakers because it was for the ladies, you know. So they brought in some like older actors that were handsome in the day and stuff, and then they brought in me who was. I was becoming a sex symbol in Mexico, so they had to bring me. They had to bring Marco Corleone to the mix. And basically, when I got there, I got to this event. There was probably like 2,000 women in this little banquet hall. When I got there, it these women like rushed me. Like they went crazy. It was like very Elvis Presley like 1950s, 1960s Elvis Presley. And what's crazy is I ended up sitting next to the vice president of a cologne company, like basically like it was almost like Avon. They had like it was like basically a cosmetic company, and she said, "I'm sorry, I don't know what you do, but like you're creating quite a stir. What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm an actor, I'm a luchador." And she was like, "Can you give me your contact information?" I gave her my contact information, and literally 6 months later, she was hit me up with a whole like, "We're gonna do a fall campaign. You're gonna be the face of our cologne," and you know. So basically, I did that. You know, so like. Me finally making it in Mexico like allowed me to do all the things that I wish I had done that I felt like mediocrity in WWE. Now I finally crossed that threshold and I did everything I set out to be like you know and like you know when I would travel around with Eddie and Ray like when you stop go to restaurants and stuff imagine you know like every crowds would go to Eddie you know like he was super over you know and then Ray people knew who Ray was even though he didn't have his mask on so. I remember always being like the third guy. They'd come to me after they got their fill from Ray and Eddie, like, "Oh, Mark, can you give him an autograph?" And it sucked, you know. Or like Orton, you know, like I travel around with Evolution Orton, you know, when he was young and getting pushed, you know, like it hurt me. I was like, man, I want to be over like that. And now like now in Mexico at this point in my life in my career, like now I was kind of controlling the. You know, like I was getting the most pops. I was getting the most, you know, people chasing me outside the arenas and stuff. And it felt good. It felt really good. And like I said, it's something I'll never forget. And the experience that was amazing, just amazing.
What a brilliant career arc from being, as you put it yourself, the immature greenhorn that has gone all the way through to
All the way.
Mexico legend. Brilliant. We applaud you, Mr.
Yep.
Jim Grant. We applaud you. We
Thank
love
you.
it. Before we go into our big game show at the end, which is obviously Winner Stays On, is a Meltdown special. I am going to pose this question to you. Do you think that you will pursue acting again, or would you like to take on the pro wrestling world one more time?
You know, I in ter you know, like I basically stopped wrestling in 2018. And then I took a lot, like I came to America. I married a Mexican girl and we had a baby. I had a baby in Mexico. He's 8 years old now. But basically when we came over to the United States in 2018, I didn't wrestle. I didn't wrestle for like 3 or 4 years. And then just up to a few years ago, I started wrestling shows and stuff, a few in Mexico, some here in the States. But nothing crazy. Like it was just like you know, I stepped away from it and stuff, and then I came back for a while, and it was kind of cool and stuff. And but you know, I basically in my life right now, like I'm okay not wrestling anymore. I don't want to. It was cool to. I scratched an itch when I took a hiatus, and I came back after the pandemic. Like I started wrestling a little here and there. So like I said, scratched the itch. But as a wrestler, like my. Physical attributes have diminished, you know, like it age gets the best of it. I'm 48 years old now. And, you know, like I still dunk a basketball though. Just, you know, I still can dunk a basketball. I do it once a year. But it just sucks. And I always said to myself, like when I can't do the things I did in my 20s and 30s, I think I'm gonna hang it up. And so I'm okay hanging it up. And in terms of, acting and stuff, like, I'll tell you my main thing I do now, like it's you guys might laugh, but like by day and by night, my lane right now is I'm like into big in the sports collectibles, like baseball cards, basketball cards, football cards. And that's what I basically do by day. Like I run a baseball card shop, you know, which is the easiest job in the world. I enjoy it. I have an eBay store and stuff. So I just basically, I'm retired. I still work, but I'm working at something that doesn't feel like work. So I guess I can officially say I'm retired, but I just, that's my thing. I just have relaxing days. I watch my son grow up. He's 8 years old, like I said. And we live in Knoxville, Tennessee, and it's a real calm life. You know, I had a great time in Mexico, traveled a lot, did a lot of things. You know, but back here in the States, like I have my family, and it's just every night, every day, it's just very, very relaxing stuff. You know, I don't have, like I said, my job is very cool. I don't have to do much. So I can work out. You know, I became a lot like a sportsaholic. You know, I really like the Yankees.
I see that.
Really, the Yankees. Football season, I love football. I just watch a lot of sports. I gravitated a lot towards sports. You know, like because when I wrestled, you know, Brian, when you're out the, you know, traveling 5-6 days a week, like it's hard to keep up with other sports teams and athletes, and you know. You can't see the Lakers playing because you're wrestling in this town or that town, you know, yeah. Like, so when wrestling was done, when I had no other obligations and stuff, man, I felt so great to be able to, you know, weekends when we usually would have to wrestle the dates wrestling. I have my weekends free. I get to wake up on Saturdays and watch College Game Day, NFL Sunday. Like, you know, I'm a huge sports fan. So, so I'm not going to wrestle anymore. I'm okay with it. And acting, I think, is, you know, I'm here in Knoxville, Tennessee. Like it maybe Atlanta would have has a bigger acting market and stuff, but like, I'm okay with my life right now. Like I'm okay. I love the lane I'm in. It's really relaxed. My first goal before I ever wanted to become an athlete was to have a little baseball card shop when I was little. That was my dream. Obviously, like, you know, I'm kind of pursuing, I went back to my dream after basically wrestling got done. So, yeah, my day is basically family and just really chilling out and having a great time.
Sounds like you checked all the boxes, man. I'm proud of you. That's awesome for you to be able to experience that international fame and being basically a rock star. And that's awesome, man. I'm glad for you.
Yeah. And, you know, and, I just love, you know, I value so much like the peace and quiet now, you know, like yeah. I almost like, because I had such a wild time in Mexico, like I've sowed every wild oat that I have in my body, you know, like, yeah. It's just a wonderful feeling to, and, you know, you talked about checking all the boxes. The major box that I've checked off that I know is so, so important. As you get older is mental health, you know? And, I, every day, like I literally can go, like I spend a lot of time with my family. I watch all the sports I like to watch. I do a job that I absolutely love. I come home and I still do the same job at my desk while I'm watching sports. It's like, and like, I can think of times I had the most money in my life. I can think of the times I've been the most over in my sport or wrestling in my life, but like none of them, made me one tenth as happy as I am right now. And like every day I wake up and I chase that happiness, you know, my 8 year old, to see my wife, you know, to take my wife, she's from Mexico, you know, she's very few things she's seen in America. You know, we lived in upstate New York for a while. So I took her to see like Niagara Falls, you know, like imagine somebody in your country that has seen very little, you know, so we have fun going to see different things. And, you know, I just took her to, Opryland in Nashville. She's never been there. You know, that was fun to take her to. She's been to Niagara Falls. I've taken her to Times Square. She's been to Hollywood, you know, like all these things. It's great. And my son, who's 8 years old, he's already bilingual. You know, he speaks Spanish and, you know, and English. I've got the cheat code for happiness now. And I've never been happier than, even in my career, like I'm 10 times happier now and I'm happy because sometimes, you know, you hear stories of people like, I mean, depressed or things aren't going well. I mean, look at my partner, Sean O'Hare, you know, like, God rest his soul. He committed suicide, you know, like something was going on in his life where he couldn't find that happiness that I had. You know, if he could have found that happiness, even though half of the happiness that I have right now, he'd probably still be with us, you know? So that more than anything, more than accolades, more than any money, more than happiness is like the biggest box of all to check off, I feel.
We love to promote that, don't we, Brian? We love to promote that here on The Meltdown. We are a very positive show. We like to shine a light on the positive stories out of pro wrestling and the good side. You found your happy place. It's all about positive mental health and well-being. So, Mr. Jindrak, you have smashed it in life, good sir. Well done.
Nice.
Well, let's see, as you smashed it in life, how well you smash it in our final feature, which is our game show. It's time to play Winner Stays On. And
all
if
right.
You've seen it before, if we've got new viewers out there and we are attracting new viewers for each and every single episode, our graphs are going steadily up. We're going to find out which hand stays steadily up because I'm going to pose two names to you, one in each hand. You are going to naturally keep one. And you're going to naturally drop one. It's fast. It's furious. We don't need an explanation why you've done it. Albeit, I will look down that lens and I'll be able to tell why. And we'll create a reel from it. Let's see how well you do. Because your topic for Winner Stays On.
Okay.
Best drop kicks in the business.
Okay.
Mark Jindrak, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's do this, brother. First two names, Hardcore Holly and AJ Styles.
I'll go Hardcore Holly.
Boom. AJ is gone. Hardcore Holly, Ricky Morton.
Hardcore Holly.
Holly's keeping it rolling. Hardcore Holly or Mr. Perfect?
Hardcore Holly.
Could we have an Otto Bonds on our hands?
I don't know.
Hardcore Holly or Randy Orton?
You know, I'll go Hardcore Holly. Like, I think Orton was more athletic and maybe he could get a little higher on his dropkick, but I'm going Hardcore Holly.
Wow. Okay.
Let's keep with it, Bob. Let's keep with it. Excellent. Okay. Hardcore or Billy Gunn?
Ooh. Hardcore.
Hardcore or Barry Windham? That was a good dropkick.
Very good dropkick. I still really like Hardcore Holly.
Good. All right. It could go all the way to the end, brother. I'm looking down my list. I'm trying to figure out who's going to beat him. Hardcore Holly or Maven?
Ooh. Maven's a good friend of mine. We still stay in touch a lot. I'm going to go Maven because Maven, with his dropkick, eliminated the Undertaker from the Royal Rumble. So,
yes.
Got to go Maven.
Very good. Maven, please feel free to share this on your YouTube page. Maven or Chris Jericho?
Maven. Maven.
Maven or Lance Storm?
Ooh. You know, I'll go Lance Storm on that. He did. Yep.
So long, Maven. Lance or Paul London?
I'll go Lance.
Lance or Dolph Ziggler?
Lance.
Lance or Mark Jindrak?
That's a no-brainer. That's Mark Jindrak.
Yes! Do it.
That's how you do it, brother. He is over like Rover.
Yes.
What a journey that's been, Brian, right?
I thought Holly was going to... He did went on a big run there, but that's great, Mark, because your dropkick was phenomenal. No doubt about it.
We mentioned Otto Vance, and we started with Otto and Alex Wright, and he went from one all the way through to the end.
Yep.
So we have to drop that. That's our benchmark now, right, Brian? Everything gets an Otto Vance.
So far, yeah.
I like it. That was awesome. Oh, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys. It's been really, really fun. Like you guys said, it's such a positive show, and I wish you guys continued success. It's awesome.
We appreciate it, Mark. I'm glad we got to reconnect, man. And I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to visit us here on The Meltdown. And we wish you nothing but more continued success. And I hope to see you again real soon, my friend.
I hope so too, man. Thank you. Thank you so much, Brian.
Absolutely, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's a natural born thriller, Marco Corleone, Mark Jindrak.
Thank you so much.
He is a household name in Mexico. He is an epic memory, from the 2000s in WCW. He is a natural born thriller, and he is now a proud member of the Meltdown alumni. He is Mark Jindrak, and such a pleasure having him with us. What epic stories that he told about his journeys all over the world. It was great to have him on, right, Brian?
What a wonderful story of a young Mark Jindrak in WWE, and then being able to grasp everything that he wanted to achieve in Mexico, being a major star, a champion down there, and even a soap opera star. He was all over Mexico. I mean, he did it all. And I'm so proud to hear that story of being able to, as he said, get the massive pop and be accepted international, man. He just did a great job.
And it comes full circle, as we said at the end of his show, from going from that immature greenhorn all the way to a national treasure in Mexico, and now to be able to reap the rewards and the fruits of his labor, to be able to embrace sports memorabilia the way that he does and sit back and enjoy the life. And I think you can only enjoy the simpler things as you become more mature in your life. So as I get older, I appreciate little things. Just the silence of a day really just makes me smile. So to Mark Jindrak, thank you so much for taking us on a positive journey. Well, we are going to put a nice little pin and tie everything up this week here on the Meltdown. We're going to hold our Meltdown mailbag until next week, where we've got some very interesting questions coming from Greenville, South Carolina. We've got questions from over here in the UK, from the West Midlands and beyond. I'm going to be posing them through to the Creation of Devastation. So I'm going to bat it over to the big man to wrap everything up on this beautiful episode. From me here in Manchester, it's been a gorgeous evening with you all. We'll see you again from this Meltdown Monday. My name's Tom Finkill. Abu.
Thank you, Tomcat. Again, a great episode with Mark. And again, I love his journey, the positivity of it, and him being able to shine. And now he is actually enjoying life. And like you said, enjoying the little things in life make it all worthwhile. So thank you all for joining us on this great episode of The Meltdown. And we will see you next Monday right here, where we do what we do best. And that is breaking necks and cashing checks.
A-boom.